Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sweet 16 edition of Stick to Wrestling. We made it to 16 episodes, amazingly enough. My name is John McAdam, and I am here with my good friend Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you doing?
Fantastic.
You're not going to be doing fantastic next week when you're missing the Patriots because we're recording.
Well, I'm focused on this. I actually did research for this week's show.
I do know that, and I am very grateful for that. But then, so like I said, everyone out there, pray for Sean all week because he's going to be missing, like I said, a good hour and a half of the Pats Indy game.
Playing, I don't think that's going to be a big deal.
Neither do I. I am confident on this one, at least for now. Before I forget to tell everyone this, we have a Facebook group. It is the Stick to Wrestling Facebook group. It is easy to find, and if you enjoy this show, I think you'll enjoy the group. You are invited. Today, Sean and I, for the first time since we've been together, we have a guest. And someone told me, oh man, Stick to Wrestling, it's such a gift. Well, we're going to put a bow on it. Bo James, how are you today, sir?
Doing wonderful. And so I don't confuse anybody, I'm the one speaking with the Southeastern and Appalachian accent.
Everyone's going to get you and Sean mixed up for the next hour. It's going to be
absolutely Boston, and it's so close. First of all, just as a correction, Bo is not our first guest. We also had the great Brian Lass.
About him. Oh, that's right. I'm just so used to talking to Brian, like on a regular podcast. I don't even look at him as a guest, but I do stand corrected.
Yes, that was a good show. But this way, I am excited because we are going to be discussing the 1977 Memphis War,
which Bo knows a lot about.
Yes, when it comes to Tennessee wrestling, Bo is the man to talk to.
Absolutely. And you know what? I mean, this week is going to be a little bit different because I am going to be in the passenger seat and Sean, you are going to be in the driver's seat.
Yes. Again, research has been done for this one. So to start off, let's start like around 1974. Bo, could you describe what the Tennessee wrestling landscape looked like in 1974?
Until fall of 74, before Ron Fuller got here, Tennessee was in four different territories with inside the state and the states that touched Tennessee. You had the Memphis end, which was Memphis, Louisville, Evansville, part of Arkansas, part of Mississippi, and all of West Tennessee that was ran by Jerry Jarrett through the Gulas Welch office. Then you had the Nashville end, Nashville, Chattanooga, Birmingham, Huntsville, Middle Tennessee, Middle Kentucky, and Northern Alabama, which was controlled by Nick Gulas, Roy Welch, and whoever was booking for them at the time. Then you had Knoxville, which was John and George Kazana, and they ran Knoxville on Friday night, and they ran a spot show within 50 miles of Knoxville on Saturday. They were only a two-day-a-week office. Then you had Kingsport, which in 74 was ran by Ron Wright, different partners, his brother, Don Wright, Jim Hayes, and it's been rumored, and I can never get anybody to confess yes or no, that Johnny Weaver had 10 points in Kingsport also, which I believe he did because he was the one that brought the Mid-Atlantic crew in here when Ron sued Nick and Roy and was trying to run inside of Tennessee, and they got the commission called on them, and the commission shut that down. So there was four different offices here. Kingsport ran in all the way to Marion, Virginia, up to Harlan and Hazard, Kentucky, those spot shows up there, and to the North Carolina line. They did not cross into North Carolina because of Crockett, and they did not go east of Marion, Virginia, because Crockett owned everything on the other side of that.
Now, I have a question. Geographically, I really don't know this. Where is Kingsport?
We are on the Tennessee-Virginia line.
Okay.
If you go just outside of the city limits to the north, you cross into Scott County, Virginia, Weber City, Gate City area there. And if you go 20 miles to the south, you're in Johnson City. You go 20 miles to the east, you're in Bristol. That's why it's called the Tri-Cities. It makes a perfect triangle.
Gotcha.
What was the relationship with between Nick Gulas and that organization and the rest of the groups?
Kingsport, Mickey Barnes had the most success here in the territory, and that's who, he was Ron's mentor. He sponsored the amateur team at the boys club that Ron and Don and Whitey came from, and they worked very close with Jim Crockett Promotions because Jim Crockett is from Bristol, and the first town that Jim Crockett ever promoted was Kingsport. When he worked here hanging posters and promoting towns and doing the publicity work for the guy who originally opened up, Pete Moore, who opened up Southeastern Booking Incorporated out of Bristol in the 30s. And Charlotte and Nashville are about the same distance from Kingsport. Both of them are about 4 hours from here. So Crockett would send talent in here. They would book guys out of Nashville through Goulis and Welch. Plus, we had our own local stars here, Ron and Don and Whitey and Jim White. Sam Bass started here, married a lady from here. He considered this to be home. Frank Morrell's from here. So a lot of homegrown talent. This was Tennessee is one of the few places where the local guys got pushes. You know, Memphis had Lawler, and then we had the Wrights and Whitey and those guys up here on this end.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. One thing I noticed.
No, go right ahead, John.
When I got Southeast Championship Wrestling for a little while in early 1980, everyone was billed, I mean, quite literally, I don't want to say all, but many of the big stars were being billed as being from Knoxville. And we're talking guys like Dick Slater, Killer Carl Cox, et cetera, who I'm like, wow, these guys are all from here. Don Diamond was billed from Knoxville.
Ooh. I don't remember them being billed from here on the TV. I'm thinking Don Diamond was, they said he was from Florida or Georgia.
Did they? I might have gotten the name wrong, but I mean, that was something that really surprised me that they, well, you know, when they announced him on TV from Knoxville, Tennessee, and I was like, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you had guys like Rick Connors was from Knoxville who trained White Boy and Tim Horner and Doug Furness. He was a longtime Knoxville guy, worked for everybody here from Kazana all the way to through the Fullers and through Blackjack and Flair when they owned the territory. So they, a lot of talent came out of East Tennessee.
I believe it.
As a quick aside, could you? I have a fascination with this show. Could you tell me a little bit? Tell us a little bit about the Kazana show. I love the show.
The TV?
Yes.
They never wrote anything on paper. They had no format. Kingsport did the same way. Mickey Barnes hosted for years. He hosted the studio show out of Johnson City. They did not want to smarten anybody up at the TV station, so nothing was ever wrote down. So at start of TV, when they were going live, they knew who they were going to work with, I'm assuming, at least a few minutes before that, but Mickey in Johnson City or Kazana in Knoxville would come in and go, first segment, you do this, 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 and this. They would go through it. While they're going through it, he's telling the second segment during the commercial break what they're doing. There was no long-term planning. They knew what they wanted to do, but they were figuring out how to get there as it was happening. That's why it was total chaos. And if the audio that I shared yesterday on the Stick to Wrestling Facebook page, those audios where Ron Wright just goes out there and does an interview for 6 or 8 minutes. They were 6 or 8 minutes short, and they would just tell Ron and Don, go talk until we go off the air. And that's what they would do.
Now, the show is available online, and I'm sure a lot of us have seen the clips of Ron and Big Jim Hess having a famous argument about the chair. One of the chairs is too high, and Ron's complaining about the chairs aren't too high. Okay, that whole bit. And I just had a fascination with this entire show, and I remember I was having a conversation with Bo online about it, and I'd mentioned that. I'd said, it has a great feeling of chaos. He goes, no, it wasn't a feeling. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. Jim Hess, everything, I never met Jim, but everything that I ever heard about him, he was a wonderful, wonderful human being. The boys just absolutely loved him, but they all said the same thing about him. He's nuts.
How so?
He was just crazy. If he got mad, he would just start yelling at you. So the emotions you saw with him and Ron Wright and whoever else the heel at the time was, those were the real emotions coming out of Jim Hess. And they knew if we could make Jim that mad, the people are even madder.
That was Jim and Ron Wright had this great relationship. It was like Lawler would always have a good promo, but when he was with Lance, it was something different.
Yeah,
they had this kind of rapport. There was the same thing with it seemed like it was the same thing with Ron and Jim Hess. They seemed to have this kind of rapport where Ron really could get to Jim, and Jim would lose his temper for pretty much every interview they had.
Ron would. I don't know where these stories come from. He was quick-witted and a wonderful storyteller. And he came up with this in the early 70s, that he had bought a gorilla and had it in his backyard. And every day before he left the house, he went out back and just beat that gorilla half to death. And he was telling the story. And Jim Hess would be sitting there and just yell out, "Oh, come on. You don't own a gorilla. You can't whip a gorilla." And then Ron would fire back and dare him to come to his house in Kingsport, watch him beat up the gorilla. He'd talk about kicking the bear and all this different stuff. And he would just tell these stories, and Jim would call him on them every time. But when Ron was a babyface and another heel would be sitting out there talking bad about Ron Wright, Jim would start yelling, "You don't want to mess with him. He's whooped a gorilla before."
Now, just you've been great. Jim Hess is like the Gordon Solie of this, right?
Yeah.
Okay, just wanted to make that clear.
He was a local TV and radio guy, a legendary broadcast guy in Knoxville. Did the sports report. He had a morning show on Channel 26 for years. I mean, he did all kinds of stuff in TV and radio. So he was a big time celebrity.
And he's a good commercial reader too.
Yeah. You know, and he had that star power when they started the TV. We need somebody to do this. And he was like Ron, just turn the red light on and point the camera at him and let him go.
Like I said, it was kind of off topic, but I had to get it because I have a fascination with that show. there's only one of them in existence. I've seen it 20 times. And I watch it like there's a Bruda film. Trying to find like little bits and pieces. Yeah, it's so good.
Did you watch the one I sent you of him interviewing Randy Savage?
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Yeah, I posted.
Yeah, it's on the Facebook page.
Savage is debut at Knoxville, doing the Macho Man stuff, really starting to put that thing together, and he's talking about how great he is, and just out of nowhere, Jim Hess says, "If you're so great, how come you never been here before?" He just killed him right there.
He is. You've been blessed in Tennessee with some very good wrestling announcers. So now we come up and it's coming up to 70. When did discussion start about from Jarrett about leaving? Was this something that was? I mean, was it a dispute or was it Jarrett looking for an opening to break off?
The thing that I have always been told from Bill Dundee and other people that were there at the time, when Jarrett got Memphis so hot, Louisville hot, the whole territory was on fire. He went to Nick and Roy and told them he didn't want to be just the booker, an employee. He wanted to be a partner in the whole operation. So they had papers drawn up, and Jerry Jarrett started paying in, thinking he was buying into the territory. Then the dispute came up. And here's another thing. In 1975, probably 74, all the way up to the split, there was 100 full-time wrestlers living in Nashville because there were so many towns running every week. Memphis, Birmingham, Evansville, Louisville, Bowling Green, Huntsville, Chattanooga, Cleveland, all these towns were running every week. So they had to have different crews in there every week, at least a few different wrestlers every week. So guys bounced around. They ran 40, 50 spot towns a week too. I mean, to this day, nobody knows for sure how many towns they were running a week. I would guess anywhere from 60 to 80 towns a week were running out of Nashville. So you had a Nashville booker, you had Jarrett booking the other end. Then you had a Teeny who would just make sure that certain guys went to certain TVs to do the jobs on TV. Then you had guys like Buddy Wayne, who was just booking spot towns, and they would send the guys to those towns, smaller towns, got guys that were on TV that weren't necessarily big stars, but were seen on TV. They were sent there with maybe one headlining match. Somebody had to coordinate all that. And during one of the booking meetings, as they're figuring out who's going where, Nick Gulas tells Jerry Jarrett, you're going to have to start booking George on your end of the territory, George Gulas. And before we get into this, I have to say this publicly, as I have before when I've talked about this. I know George Gulas. My wife and I have wrestled for George when he's ran towns. He has always been a prince of a guy to us. He has always treated us great. He's always paid us good. He's always put us up in the nice hotel. He has always been nothing but good to me. But a lot of people had resentment against George because he was Nick's son. People want to say he was the worst wrestler of all time. I counter that with, have you ever seen Tex McKenzie?
I have. Oh.
You know, but they wanted George to start working the Memphis end, and Jerry Jarrett did not want him. And he said, no, I'm not taking him. I'm not using him. I'm not doing this. And you can't make me because I have bought into a partnership and I have equal say. Well, they come to find out he wasn't buying a partnership. He was buying an option to buy if they decide to sell. So they had been taking money from him for a long time. And in return, he was getting nothing. And he finally said, enough, enough. I'm the one that built this town and all the other towns inside of it. I can do it on my own. And he started going to the guys one by one to see if they wanted to go with him or stay with Nick. And they all left except Fargo and Tojo. And the biggest problem was they did not have TV. Nick had Channel 13, the big TV in Memphis, and the tape that was bicycled everywhere. So Lawler was on board with Jarrett, going to be partners with Jarrett. Lawler goes to Channel 5 one day, walks in. Of course, they know who he is. He's the biggest star in Memphis. And he says, how would you like to have your own TV show and draw the ratings that they're getting on Channel 13? That's how they got TV, and they were off to the races.
Wow. You know, one thing that really fascinates me about this, we're talking about, you know, having all of those towns, you got to remember this is, you know, the state of Tennessee in in the early to mid 70s, and they haven't built all those highways yet. I mean, these guys are going on, you know, some back roads to get to the shows.
Oh yeah, especially on this end, going to Harlan, Kentucky. Oh my God, I go to Harlan several times a year because we promote East Kentucky, and the roads are the same, other than a few places they've flattened off a mountaintop here or there, or put a third lane in where you can get around the coal trucks or whatever. That's why on this end, Ron Wright had a plane and they flew guys because it would be like Harlan, Kentucky from Kingsport is like 68 miles. It will take you 2.5 hours to get there.
That's where I was coming from. Exactly.
So he could fly out of the Tri-Cities Airport here in his little four-seater and be in Harlan in 10, 15, 20 minutes, whatever, to fly. I mean, it's not far. It's just over two mountains and you're there.
And I've been to Harlan. I can testify to that, you know, it's not exactly a straight line to get there.
And the other thing you have to realize, going to Harlan, they knew this back years ago, you're going to have to fight for your life. Because somebody in the crowd's going to try you, or there's going to be a full-fledged riot. You know, Harlan, Hazard, Pennington Gap, Virginia, Irwin, Tennessee, Greenville, Tennessee, they were known as riots. That's why a lot of guys came here to work the Kingsport Inn, and they didn't stay long because they didn't like getting, you know, old men with pocket knives coming after them every night or getting shot at in the ring or in the parking lot.
That's there's an old documentary called Harlan County USA about
When we book people to come in to work Appalachian Mountain Wrestling, I send that video to them and I say, watch this because you need to learn the mentality of these people we're dealing with.
It was about a coal miner strike. And that even though women were like, yeah, I was looking at some of those women and I'm waiting for them to drop and start to swing. These are tough people.
These mountains are full of tough people and proud people. Yeah. When outsiders come in, they're not welcomed.
Okay, so now I have the first card that Jarrett ran after the split in March 20th, 1977. When was the decision made?
Early March.
Oh, two so weeks, it was two quick.
Weeks, 2 weeks out. Oh, yeah, they had to strike fast. They had to do it quick.
And the first card was in the Cook Convention Center.
That's an old arena downtown where wrestling okay. was at before they built the Coliseum. That's where the Monday night cards were at.
How would that compare to the Mid-South Coliseum, that building?
Half the size, a third of the size. It's instead of a big round dome, it's more of a square building with bleachers on two sides and then floor seating all the way across. Probably 4,000 seats, maybe.
Because I actually have the attendance. That's why I was asking, because they have the attendance figure here is 8,000. And I was like, that can't possibly be right.
They were jam-packed. There wasn't no fire marshals back then.
Yeah, that's true. The main was Lawler versus Armstrong, Bob Armstrong. And
you know what's amazing about that? Is Bob Armstrong was front and center for the split in Atlanta and the split in Memphis and the split in Knoxville.
Well, the difference was, was Bob the only one who stayed in the Atlanta one?
Bob and one other, and I can't think of who the other guy was. Yeah.
So Bob, but in this case, Bob went with Jarrett.
Yeah.
Because this was the first few out of the gate and he would come back.
Yeah.
Have you talked to, do you know Bob? I'm assuming.
Oh yeah. I've known Bob since I was 14 years old.
Oh, wow. Did he say why he went with Jarrett on this one?
No, I've never really talked to Bob about the Jarrett. And I always talked to him about, you know, Southeastern and Continental because sure. Bob was the first guy in Knoxville really to get over as a baby face after Whitey Caldwell was killed. He filled that hole of, they were looking for a hero, and Bob was the guy that rode in here on the white horse and became the hero in Knoxville.
Great baby face.
One thing that kind of confused me was how the NWA support went. Now, Gullis is technically the NWA guy.
Yeah, but who went with Jerry Jarrett when he went?
Roy Welch.
No, Roy stayed with Nick.
Oh, did he stay with, so it was Buddy Fuller?
Buddy Fuller, Edward Welch. And so they had a Welch on each side, and the Welches controlled everything in touching Tennessee and you know, in the Southeast pretty much other than Charlotte, so nobody else wanted to get involved.
How did that split affect their family? I mean, that's kind of a, you know, between Roy and Buddy.
I don't think it affected it any. They both were making money on both sides.
That makes sense.
You got to remember, the Welches would get mad and run against each other all the time. Somebody in the family. The Goldens would run against the Fields at times, and some of them came to Nashville and ran against Roy because they got mad at him and Nick over something.
How willing was Buddy to open? Was Buddy, did that take a lot of arm twisting?
I don't think so, because Buddy was part of the first big movement in Memphis to get it put on the map. That was one of the first cities that he helped catch fire.
And Buddy had a passing something to do with the Atlanta War, didn't he?
Yeah, they all were involved in that. The Welch family, you have to look. They were involved in Kingsport. They were involved in Knoxville. They were involved in Atlanta, Mobile, Tampa, Nashville, Memphis. They ran tours to different islands in the Caribbean. They had their hands in everything.
But when the actual split in Memphis happened, the NWA decided, again, officially there were guys, I guess they were neutral, per se, because there was a Welch, as you said, there was a Welch on each side.
Right.
But in the early days, Harley Race came in, and you had Dusty Rhodes coming in to Memphis for Jarrett.
Yeah. You also have to remember, not a lot of people like Nick Gulas.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going with it.
Yeah, and you know, that I don't think there was any arm twisting. If you take Jerry Jarrett, who was a young guy, Lawler's young guy, but all these guys were in their primes, young studs, Bob Armstrong, all these guys, and Jerry Jarrett made them all money on his end of the territory. So if he said, look, I'm going to go and you're going to make the same money and business is going to be the same as usual and you don't have to deal with Nick, of course they're going to jump right on top of it.
For the Battle of Memphis did not last long.
No, because Channel 13 canceled TV when they realized all of these stars that have drawn all these ratings and these big crowds are now on Channel 5. Channel 13 canceled the wrestling program.
The last coolest card I have here is Jackie Fargo against the Russian Stomper, who I don't know who that is. Nonetheless, it's Jackie Fargo. 484 attendance.
Yeah. No TV.
That's amazing. Stomper was one of the Yukon Lumberjacks in the WWF.
There was three or four different Russian Stompers through Tennessee times. Yeah. It's just like the interns, the medics, anything that got over, they made another one so they could send him to another town.
Yeah.
You know, it was nothing to have the assassins in the main event in Birmingham and also three different sets of assassins or interns or blue infernos in three different spot shows the same night.
It's one of my favorite things about wrestling, how they can just do stuff like that. They, you know, at one point, supposedly Dallas had Kabuki working two cities because they had two guys using the gimmick.
Yeah. You know, and you got to look at all the guys here worked the same style pretty much. So all you had to do was put them in the outfit and send them to the town.
Exactly.
And they had no, there was no internet, no cell phones, no, I mean, it cost you a day's pay to make a long distance phone call. So nobody was calling around to see, hey, who was in Birmingham or who was in here and there. I mean, there was a few people that were trading newspaper clippings and different things that might have figured it out. But they may have thought, too, it's just a misprint or they've double booked them, so they had to go to one of these towns, not the other one.
That makes sense.
Jarrett finally ended up in the end of April, ended up getting the Mid-South Coliseum.
Which is magical place. I turned 21 years old in the Mid-South Coliseum.
One of the places I have to go to.
When you sit in the dressing room and you're in the hallway waiting to go to the ring in Memphis, you feel all that history. You feel the ghost of the years past. You know I am in a special place, and it's an unreal feeling. Same thing at Channel 5. When you're standing there waiting to go through that curtain, you think about all the people that went through that curtain before you.
Well, you mentioned that, could you talk about Lance and Dave's influence on getting the TV?
To getting Channel 5?
Didn't they mention something along the lines of, we can also probably get you the number one, we can get you the number one weather guy?
We will try.
Yeah.
Lawler had never spoke to him about it. That was a selling point. Yeah, we can try. But then once Nick was gone and once, you know, there was no wrestling over there and Channel 5 was the bigger station and growing, they were able to get Lance and Dave to come. Which Lance just went to work do the wrestling show. He pretty much retired from TV. And Dave went on to be the weather guy. And Lance worked because Lance would do the interviews for all the towns. And he would go to some of the towns. And he became an employee of the territory.
And as Dave was just getting paid for that one spot.
Right.
The shows. Yep. Okay. This is a great year for them, for Memphis. You had, at the beginning of the year, you had Lawler against Armstrong and Lawler against Rocky Johnson.
Yeah. They brought Rocky in as a boxer, said he was Muhammad Ali's sparring partner. They brought tapes of him boxing and training and all this stuff they sent in, and they did a boxer versus wrestler with him. Rocky Johnson, Lawler beat him because he had the gloves on, and Rocky said, look, I'm going to learn how to do some of this wrestling stuff. I think I can do it, and if it comes down to fist, I can knock him out. Nobody knew Rocky Johnson was a wrestler before he got there.
That's a great angle.
And in, I think, July 1977, one of the legendary feuds in Memphis history starts, Lawler-Dundee.
It's the feud.
What made it so special?
Look how much longevity they got out of it.
What about that year, though, that summer, the first time?
Because it was the first time.
It was, and they kept...
You got to remember, Dundee got here in 75, January 1st of 75. When he got to Tennessee, Lawler had a dispute with Jerry Jarrett and Nick Gulas. And Lawler went to Florida for a while. And Dundee got over, first as a heel, then as a babyface. And he became the superstar. And then Lawler comes back, and they're both kind of on the same side at times and this and that. They never touch until 77. When they finally started, people were ready. It's like the two toughest kids in the schoolyard. Before this school year is out, they're going to have to fight. Before this is done with and all over with, they're going to have to see who really is the toughest.
You know, you mentioned Dundee arriving in Memphis. Dundee has told the story so many times that I actually believe it. He said when he got off the plane, he had so little money that he walked from the airport to the arena.
He sure did. I've known Bill Dundee since I was 14. When I wrestled in Memphis, I rode with Bill Dundee. Bill Dundee has spent Christmas Day here at my house. I've been to his home many times. Me and Bill are very close, keep up with each other. And I did a 3-part, 6-hour Memories of the Superstar with Dundee a few years ago, where me and him, just like we are, sit in front of a camera, and we talked about his career. No notes, nothing. I knew his career so well, we went right through it. They got here. It took them a year to get the paperwork done to get the visa to come to America. They filed January 1st, 74. They got the papers. January 1st, 75, they were on the next plane out of Sydney to come to Nashville. They had no money, just hopes and dreams. And George Barnes stayed with him for 3 months, and he said, I've had enough of this place, I'm going home. And Dundee said, I come here to be a star, and I'm not going to fail.
Now, the feud had pretty much every stipulation you could imagine. Week after week, you would just keep adding stipulations to it.
Yes.
I think Jerry's car was a stipulation for one of them.
Put the Cadillac up, put the belts up, put money up, put hair up.
Put wife's hair up.
put Bev's hair up.
How much did they get for that?
Do you know why they did that?
A lot of money.
The money. They came to Dundee. Lawler said in a meeting, what if we shave your head? And Dundee said, what kind of money are you talking about? And I don't remember the figure. Bill gives it in the Memory of the Superstars. He tells you the exact figure that he was paid. That was the down payment on their new house in Hendersonville, Tennessee. So a week later, they're trying to figure out what to do. And they had already had Bev come out and slap Lawler and this and that. And Lawler made a statement in the meeting. What if we shave Beverly's head? And everybody laughed. And Bill said, same money? And they said, if she's willing to do it, we'll pay the same money. So they did. And that's why she got her head shaved. They bought the furniture and everything inside the house and still had like 2 months worth of house payments.
That is crazy, and Bill Dundee and Jerry Lawler talked about that angle. I mean, we're talking into the 90s; they were still talking about that.
Yeah, you know when they when the barber got in the ring to shave her head, he refused to do it because the people were about to riot, and he was scared to death. He said, "I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it." And they said, "You have to do it." So they plugged the clippers in, and every time he went to cut her hair, a fan would reach in and unplug them. And they'd plug them up again. Another guy would, or woman would do it, and just kept going on and on and on. So Dundee had to get on the mic and said, look, if she doesn't go through with this, I can't wrestle here anymore. So they started shaving her head, and the people started throwing stuff, and they never taped it. They never made a film of it because they knew the heat it was going to get, and they were afraid if it broke out in a full-fledged riot, they did not want evidence. So they shaved her head. They only got like half of it shaved and then the back, and the people were so bad that I think it was Eddie Marlin or somebody came to the ring and said, you got to get out of here because it's going to get out of hand. So they finished shaving her head at the back of the building.
I love stories like that. That is absolutely insane.
I have to ask you, you brought up something a minute ago about the meeting where they were kind of discussing the angle. Who would be in this meeting? I'm just curious. I'm trying to get a visual.
Lawler, Dundee, Jerry Jarrett, if someone else was booking at the time, and whoever had their hands in the cookie jar, whoever owned points in the territory and who the top guys were.
How did Jarrett's booking, because John and I were talking, I believe it was last week, complimenting the Memphis style of having 6 months of one person and 6 months of another.
Yeah.
Were they doing that back then?
Oh, yeah, from day one. Kingsport did that, too. Kingsport, you know, it's hard. Like our promotion in Kentucky, Appalachian Mountain Wrestling, we have a TV that's on two stations in Kentucky. We run live events every week. I did the first 100 TVs in the first 2.5 years of live events. And then I said, I got to stop because I'm burnt. I'm dead. I mean, I couldn't imagine doing it where they had TV in Louisville, Evansville, Nashville, Jonesboro, Lexington, Tupelo, and a couple other places. And they had to make sure the interviews were in each tape for the right place. The angles were there. The talent was there. I mean, it's a full-time job. And it's like, you know, the wrestlers that get a day off, but whoever's in charge of that, you have no day off. What are you going to do? Stop thinking for a day?
And, you know, you were talking about producing the shows. We're talking about like 70s, you know, recording equipment.
Right.
Analog. That must have been a bear.
Yeah. When they first started, you know, 1-inch tapes, and you had to run everything in real time and drop it in and run, you know, I mean, that's why they had they hired their own guys to do the TVs. Because if they had to go through the TV station to get it done, they would have never been able to afford it. So that's why Jarrett had different relatives, and he had Mike Shields and those guys that Jarrett bought his own equipment and had it in his house and set up a studio there for them. That's all they did all day was run the tapes. And then Teeny would take them to Louisville on Tuesday, take them to Evansville on Wednesday. They put them on a Greyhound to Jonesboro and Tupelo to make sure they got there on time.
Teeny being Christine Jarrett, I believe, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And once again, I love stuff like this. Jerry Jarrett owned his own recording equipment, owned his own recording equipment, and had it in his house. That's insane.
Yeah.
That's something expensive back then.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Who was the, was Lawler the second booker then, or who would the second booker have been in 77?
I'm not sure. I know Dundee had some say in different things. Jarrett, I think most of 77 was Jarrett with ideas and details from Lawler and Dundee. That's another thing. You could be a great booker and have great ideas, but if someone's not there to make sure the details are done perfectly, it doesn't work. That's why Dusty always had JJ. That's why Ron Wright had Don Wright or Whitey Caldwell. You know, that's why Robert Fuller had his brother and his cousin there. You know, you have to have a brain trust and people that you can trust that are all working for the same goal.
Ole and Gene.
Ole and Gene.
In Georgia.
Yeah.
Fascinating car rides. Just unbelievable.
Oh, when I rode with Dundee, even to this day, if me and Bill ride somewhere together, I can't wait to get in the car because that's where you learn. And you just pick their brain and you just ask. You know, when I, the time when I was doing TV5 wrestling and wrestling in Memphis, as soon as they went live on the air, I went down the hallway right there to the curtain where you get ready to go out, and I stood right behind Jerry Lawler and watched him for the whole time that TV was on the air to see what he was doing, see the messages he was sending through the headsets, through other people upstairs. To, you know, it's unbelievable to watch the magic.
Dutch used to say when him and Jerry would Lawler would drive, that was where they booked the show.
Yeah. And you had different kind of booking too. You had the Jerry Jarrett way and the Dundee way, to where it's all formatted, it's laid out, it's detailed. You have notes, you have this, you have that. It's, there's no way it can go wrong. Then Lawler walks in Saturday morning, an hour and 20 minutes or so before you go on the air, and he's wrote it on a piece of paper driving home from Blyfield the night before.
And he was also known for his gimmicks. I couldn't help but notice on the March 20th show, in the first show they had that year after the split, Dr. Frank was on the card.
Yeah.
That's
how you know Lawler's got a hand in the book. Where is he?
Exactly.
Creatures from outer space, dead zombies, you know, you name it. Anything that he saw in the comic book is on that TV.
They actually brought in Batman.
Yeah, and Spider-Man. Bad Bad Leroy Brown became Bad Bad Leroy Brown there from the song. They had the San Diego Chicken. I mean, anything that was in pop culture, Lawler was on top of it.
So the feud with Dundee ends on September 13th, and then they bring in somebody brand new to the territory.
Handsome Jimmy. My wrestling dad.
Could you tell the story about how Handsome Jimmy got involved in this?
Handsome Jimmy and Johnny, the Valiant Brothers, are in San Francisco working for Roy Schreier. And Johnny was going through some personal stuff. The wrestling business had taken a toll on his wife. And she'd had enough of moving every 6 months, every year, whatever, you know, because you had to move on in territories. And he told Jimmy, I got to go back to Indianapolis. Because that was home. Dick DeBruiser, that, you know, that was the guy that gave him the break and everything. They considered Indianapolis home, even though they're most known for New York. And he said, okay, we'll go. And they finished up and they got back to Indianapolis, and they went to see Bruiser, and Bruiser said, I can use one of you. I don't have a spot for two. And he said, well, let Johnny stay. If you can use me, you know, in and out for a couple of weeks, I'll figure somewhere to go. And he was working some for Bruiser, and Jerry Jarrett called because they're going to do the Southern title tournament, and they wanted stars from all over the territories. And Bruiser sends him to from Indianapolis to Memphis. He was supposed to start somewhere else in a couple of weeks, and I can't remember where it was at. So he goes to Memphis to lose in the first round of the tournament. Lawler sees him and tells Jerry Jarrett, I can draw a lot of money with that guy right there. Valiant still being booked in Memphis, and then the Jarrett Towns. I just saw a video today where he's going to Owensboro, Kentucky next week.
They bought him a house.
Yeah, they bought him a house to stay there. He got over. But he was the first big, blonde-headed, tattooed, muscled-up heel that they had seen since the Fargos got there in the late 50s, early 60s. Who
now
could
this talk thing
like
turned...
nobody else, who could take these big flying bumps, that could fly for Lawler and all this stuff. And they had that chemistry, and when they put them together, it was a license to print money.
This version of Jimmy Valiant is not the Boogie Woogie Man. This guy is more closer to the guy in New York.
Yeah.
So they bring him in, and
the reason he became the Boogeyman is you have to realize when he became the boogeyman in 1980 or 81, he already had almost 20 years in the ring working 300 plus days a year, taking bumps for Bruiser and Crusher because they're not going to go off their feet, flying for Lawler, the runs in New York, the runs in Dallas, bleeding every night. I dare you to find a picture of the Valiant Brothers in a magazine in the 70s where they were not both just covered in blood. And the reason he became the boogeyman, he was beat to death. So he created, Ole gave him the idea and the name, but he created the street person. And he changed the way he works. And people want to knock it, whatever. Now I see people knock it online. They didn't live here in the Mid-Atlantic territory like I did in 83 and 84 to see it and see the houses he was drawing and how over he was. They didn't care if he had a five-star match. They wanted to hear him talk. They wanted to feel good when he danced to the ring. They wanted to cheer him when the bad guy was beating him up, and they pulled for him to win because he was the underdog. He had two careers. He had Handsome Jimmy. He had the Boogeyman.
As a WWF guy who grew up with guys like Chief J. Strongbro and Ivan Putski, etc., I totally get that.
Yeah.
When Jimmy came in, Jarrett did something that was just brilliant. But it was a ballsy move. I heard him tell the story once that he couldn't have both guys. You can't have two guys get over at the same time. So he had to get Lawler out.
Mm-hmm.
To get Valiant over.
Well, but no, so here's the deal. But hold on.
Okay.
They tell the story wrong. Are you talking about how Lawler's going to go pursue his music career?
Yeah.
They had already did that before Valiant got there.
Okay.
They had already did that because Lawler wanted a break because he was the headlining star, just like Handsome was in the other territories. Lawler wanted a break. So he relinquishes the belt. I'm going to retire. I'm going to go music. All of that had been done before Valiant ever got there. So the second week or third week that Valiant is there, they do the concert with Lawler and the Gentries, and Handsome comes out and bashes the guitar over Lawler's head.
And, of course, a member of the Gentries would be Jimmy Hart.
Jimmy Hart.
Yeah. So that went on. I mean, that feud went on for until pretty much the rest of the year. And that was almost as hard as the Dundee feud.
18 straight weeks. They were either in singles, tag, six mans, or in the corners of other guys. 18 straight weeks across the territory, sellout business, near riots. Fans setting the seats on fire in the Coliseum, people throwing bricks through the... You ever hear about the first night that Ricky Morton met Handsome Jimmy Valiant?
No.
No, but I want to.
Yeah. Okay. Everybody probably has seen this video. If you've not seen the video, it's on YouTube. Harley Race, Jerry Lawler. Lawler has to get rid of Valiant so he don't have to worry about him to get a shot at the world champion. He's got the title match, but he knows Valiant's going to interfere, so they have the match the week before the world title match, and Lawler throws the fire in Valiant's face, burns his eye in his face, and Valiant does an interview with his back to the camera, and he turns around at the very end where he threatens to kill Lawler, and he turns around as if he thinks the camera's off, and he realizes it's still on, and he starts yelling, "Don't show my face, it's not a freak show. I'm Handsome Jimmy, not a freak." And the camera goes off and he storms off. So Lawler wrestles Harley Race to an hour draw in Memphis. That matches out there too. They come back the next week with a 90-minute time limit. They have Handsome fly in from Indianapolis, because he's still living in Indianapolis, to Memphis on a late flight. They get Paul Morton's son, Ricky Morton, who's wrestled some, but not a full-time wrestler yet. He was working at the book depository in Nashville. Drive to Memphis, pick up Handsome, take him to the Coliseum, sneak him in there underneath covers. And then Handsome comes through the back door. They hand him the glass bottle. He goes straight to the ring and beats up Lawler with the glass bottle, cuts him on the chest, cuts him on the arm, bashes Harley Race. Race gets up, tries to save Lawler. if you ever see Jerry Lawler, see pictures of him after 77, look on his left shoulder and look right above his heart. He still has scars from that bottle to this day. So near right, people's fighting. The baby faces hit the ring. Valiant comes through the back. It's time to get out of there. They grab him. They take him. Ricky Morton's driving his truck, a pickup truck. Handsome jumps in. And by the time they get in the truck, get ready to leave, in the back of the Coliseum where the wrestlers parked, it's fenced, chain link fence. You can't get in or out without, because there's security there. But by the time they get out there to leave, some of the fans have already came out of the Coliseum and are waiting on them. So they're leaving, and people are in front of them and will not move. And Handsome's telling Ricky, stomp on it. We got to go. We got to go. They're going to kill us. Ricky's froze, and a guy throws a cinder block through the window of his truck. And Valiant reaches over and stomps on the gas, and they burn out and go through the people, and they have to drive because they're going to go to Louisville and Evansville the next night, back to Nashville, 200 miles in the winter with no windshield on the front of the truck.
Oh, God. I read about the Coke bottle angle when it happened, and you know, I was a kid. I was blown away by it. I mean, breaking bottles over guys' heads, that was some pretty hardcore stuff.
Jerry would take some crazy bumps back then.
Oh, he still takes them if you let him.
Really? They had to calm him down? Because I remember the bump with Joe LeDuc.
Yeah.
Where he broke his leg. That was 78?
Yes. Yeah, and then he come right back from that and then got the broke leg at the end of 79 playing football. Or early 80. It was right around Christmas.
How did after this first year and after they kind of lost Memphis, what happened with Nick Gulas?
Nick ran, he continued on with Chattanooga and Huntsville and Birmingham and spot shows and everything until, I want to say 80. Jarrett kind of made up, and Jarrett started sending talent to his cards in Nashville, and then Jarrett just kind of finally took over. Nick held on to Chattanooga until I think 82, and then he just retired. He'd had enough.
After, if I could go back to the beginning, after say, okay, so say after 77, early 78, what does the Tennessee wrestling scene look like at this point, 4 years after we just described it before?
78, you've got three offices. Knoxville and Kingsport at Fuller and Ron Wright had combined, and the territory had grown up here. They added TV and Hazard, Kentucky, Bluefield, West Virginia, Crossville, Tennessee. So the southeastern wrestling was growing. Gula still had a stronghold in the middle, and then Jarrett still had everything in the west and then up to Louisville and Evansville and Lexington. And Lexington was one of their stronger towns that once a month drawing 8,000 people regular that hardly anybody ever talks about.
Wow.
Because the cards there didn't get the coverage that Memphis or, you know, wherever else got.
Did he struggle in East Tennessee, Jarrett?
When he tried to do the
Gulas towns?
Jarrett never came here until 87.
Really? TV, I thought he tried.
His TV was on here for a long time, but he didn't try to run here until 87. He ran one card in Bristol. It was the Sunday after they had shaved Lawler's head, so Lawler was not there to work with Idol, and it drew about 350 people in a 7,000-seat arena, and they said, okay, we don't need to try that again. Because you had Continental here, plus you had Crockett here.
One thing that Jarrett did during when the whole split happened that was different than I've ever heard of before, and I thought it was really smart, was that he told the talent that this, you can go work for Nick. Because yeah, you would have guys coming back and forth. You would see, and during that time period, you would see guys working both cards.
Dennis Condrey wrestled in Tennessee for years. 6 months in Knoxville, 6 months for Gulas, 6 months for Jarrett, repeat. And he never had to leave, move more than 100 or more than 200 miles at a time.
I want to get back to you mentioning that they, you know, Jarrett tried to run Knoxville and it didn't work. And I had people ask me, you know, gee, why didn't Jarrett try to run Knoxville? And people don't realize, you know, it's all in the same state, but Knoxville and Memphis are 8 hours from each other. And I know this firsthand.
It's from my house to Channel 5 in Memphis is 508 miles.
Oy.
Why would he come here when Fuller's were on fire, selling out Knoxville every week, selling out Johnson City every week, selling out Maryville every week? I mean, he wasn't dumb. He wasn't coming in here against that, because if he would have came in here, then he would have had the NWA backlash, because this was a hotbed of the NWA.
You know, I was more talking about like when Knoxville had down periods, like 87, 88, right around that time.
Knoxville never had down periods.
Really?
Alabama died. Knoxville, every other Friday, was still doing $25,000 to $35,000.
Now, who was, now let's say 88, who was on these shows?
Okay, 88, it gets crazy, because that's what the Fuller sells off in fall of 87. He keeps the Knoxville territory, and he sells Alabama, Mississippi, and the panhandle of Florida.
All right.
So in Knoxville, he's got Tommy, Johnny, Davy Rich, Scott Armstrong, Bob Armstrong, Doug Furness, Wendell Cooley, Buddy Landale, Terry Gordy. Ron Wright returns to wrestling after a long absence. Moondogs. Mongolian Stomper returns, Mike Davis, Tommy Lane, Nelson Royal, Bill Dundee. All guys that they knew and had not seen in years, and a few guys that they had, like Davy Rich, they had not, in the RPMs, they had not seen before. Knoxville, still doing great. Chattanooga, not so good. Johnson City, not so good because Crockett took over. Spot shows in Virginia and East Kentucky. Selling out, guys making a ton of money selling merchandise.
They just didn't get a lot of publicity because it's
They did not want it. The Fullers refused to let the magazines come cover them.
Now, why is that?
Because they didn't want the bigger territories to know what kind of business they were doing, because they would raid the talent.
That, you know what? That makes sense.
Something Paulie could have learned from.
Yeah, really.
Once a year or so, they would let Napolitano or Apter or somebody come. Usually when the world champion, Flair, Race, or whoever was here, they would let them come, and the story had to be on a family member. It had to be about Welch, Fuller, Goldenfield, somebody in that family. Because they're not going to leave it. They're not going to screw them. They're not going to, you know, they're figured in.
Somebody who's not getting.
That's why guys like Johnny Rich, who had an unbelievable run for Fuller, very few people outside this territory know about. Scott Armstrong is known as a referee to most fans today. They don't know that he was the world junior champion that beat Nelson Royal. You know, they just, because they didn't want the publicity, which I didn't realize that at the time, because I used to get mad when I'd go to the magazines and, you know, there's nothing in here about my hometown wrestling.
I just, you know what? I never thought of it that way, because every other promotion is so desperate to get as much attention as they can, and some of it's business, and obviously a little bit of it is ego, but what you said totally made sense.
In 1976, Ron Garvin came to Knoxville. His guarantee for the week was $750. Now, that may not sound like a lot of money in today's money, but somebody do the math. Fuller's trip in the territory was to Bluefield, West Virginia, less than 200 miles. They slept in their bed every night. They were home every night. They worked 6 days a week, had 1 day a week off to go to the lake, go hunting, go fishing, go do whatever they wanted to do. And Garvin told me, in all the years that he worked for Fuller, never was his guarantee. He never made more or never made less than $200 more than his guarantee. He's making 50 grand a year working here in the 70s.
And
that is a lot of money.
Yeah.
The travel is a key thing too, because I remember there was in one of your books about Kingsport wrestling in the 60s.
Yeah.
You have a letter in there regarding the Dupree brothers.
Right.
And they kind of go over the travel. They basically, there is no trip for that Knoxville area that's over 90 miles, 99, well, 100 miles, something like that.
That was the Kingsport territory, different territory.
Okay, yeah.
Still separate, but same thing. Charlie Smith, oldest living referee, walking information encyclopedia, 86 years old, worked with every world champion from Bill Longston to Hulk Hogan. Smitty told me this was the only territory, Kingsport, that he worked where you left when the 6 o'clock news was coming on and you were home to watch the 11 o'clock news. And you made a lot of money.
That is mind blowing. This has been just an awesome show. Bo, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge.
Yes, thank you.
Definitely want to have you on
anytime.
Again.
Anytime. I can talk wrestling all night. And I tell you how much I wanted to do this program. My Cubs are playing for a division title right now. I'm taking time. This is the first ball game I have missed all year.
Well, thank you for taking the time. Yeah. We want Theo Epstein back. But this has been...
No, you can't have Theo. So,
he's from here. We got to have him back. Yeah. This has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Thank everyone for listening. And go Vols, beat Georgia. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that ain't going to happen.